That's Mario Balzara and his Afro-Cuban Jazz Orchestra with Mambo Rincón. That's from the album The Tanga Suite, released in 1992, the year before Balzara died at the age of 82. He was born in Havana and trained classically on clarinet and oboe and began performing with the Havana Philharmonic at the tender age of 9, and at age 19 moved to New York. He switched to trumpet and began performing with big bands in the 1930s, including Cab Calloway's famous orchestra. He joined his brother-in-law, Machito, with the Afro-Cuban Orchestra, and he was its music director and arranger for 35 years before going on his own. But during that time, both he and Machito had collaborated with many African-American jazz greats and pioneered the genres we know today as Afro-Cuban jazz, cubop, and salsa. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It's Friday, June the 6th, and you are cordially invited to free your mind. Lots and lots of news issues to talk about, but that's up to you at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888 from New York. Patricia, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon, Utrice.
Hello.
I'm going to try and sound a bit more rational today. We were talking yesterday about the president's speech in Poland this week. And as I was trying to state yesterday, I actually found the president's tone in his speech quite disturbing and actually alarming. Because, as I said, we've been accustomed to a president whose demeanor is very, very soft and conciliatory in his tone. Yet that was not the person we heard yesterday. I maintain that must be his alter ego. And the only, or maybe one explanation that I can proffer to understand this harsh tone, which was out of character for him, is that he really is feeling the heat and criticism around the recent swap of one lone American for 5 Taliban members. As you know, families of Americans who still remain captive, either in Afghanistan or in Pakistan, have criticized them harshly. Members of the Congress have criticized them harshly, and even the Taliban is characterizing his position as chicken. The United States Obama is not going to do anything. And I found that his public advocation of this overthrow of legitimate governments equally alarming, because not only did he suggest to folks in people in these countries that he do this, that they do this, but you know he sounds like a bully that says, "Don't worry, start the fight, and I'll be right behind you. You don't have to worry, you're not alone. I got your back. You're covered." And I think everyone, specifically people in those countries, need to remember that the government in the Ukraine was a democratically elected government that was overthrown by a coup that the United States and its allies in Western Europe have supported. And closer to the shores of the U.S., we must remember that we went into Haiti and took out a democratically elected head of state. So if, as you speculate, the president's plan is to come back home and ask Americans to sacrifice in this new East-West venture that's going to involve more black and brown, you know, children, men and women, and also an expenditure of millions and millions of dollars while cities are burning, while children are dying, I think that that is a sacrifice that Americans just can no longer tolerate and sustain. So I hope that your premise is not correct.
I'm hoping so too.
But if it is, it's going to be the responsibility of the American people to push back and say, no, no more. Get out. No more. You're not going to end the war in Afghanistan and bring the troops home from Pakistan only to redeploy them to another part of the world. No mas.
No mas. And you know, that is going hand in glove with the interests of the, as you call it, the military-industrial complex. With this, the atmosphere in Europe right now, in that region of the world, the United States military sector, military production sector, sees fantastic opportunities there because they want to arm everybody. And this is, you know, Poland in particular has spent an inordinate amount of money just acquiring weapons. And this is going to have a ripple effect. All of the surrounding nations will see fit because the United States, of course, has already identified Russia as the bad guy seeking to reacquire lost turf. And therefore, these nations emerging on their own will have to protect themselves against Russian aggression. And that always means billions of dollars in military and defense contracts. So part of what the president's role is in Europe right now is to, of course, as the advance guy for this this windfall in sales, in military sales. So it's all hand in glove.
You know, I feel as though this is round two, because I remember the ratcheted rhetoric when around Nikita Khrushchev and Brezhnev, mm-hmm. and it almost bankrupted us as a nation then. Mm-hmm. So to have round two be started, especially under the anti-war president, you know, he presented himself as the anti-war president, anti-military president. So to hear this ratcheting up of the rhetoric as we begin round two is just this, you know, I keep remembering how I ran to the polls to vote for this man. That's all I keep seeing before my face. I wanted to be number one at the polls. And this is what we got.
This is what we got. Thanks a lot, Patricia, for your call today.
Thank you.
Harvey, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, wonderful Utrice.
Hello, Harvey. How are you today?
Hi there. I'm fine, thanks. Well, I'd like to talk about planetary cooling. And, you know, we're breaking heat records on the planet year after year. And one thing that cools the planet are forests. And what it does is that I didn't know this myself. I just recently found out that force create evaporation, and this evaporation turns into low-level clouds that reflects the sun rays back into space. So actually, we need to replant our forests to cool the planet. And right now, because of global warming, they're being damaged by insects, more disease. There's extensive logging and larger, more frequent forest fires. So I think that this really would be a great jobs project for kids and adults. It would be getting into nature, replanting America's forests for a cooler world, and also the trees, they take the carbon dioxide. You know, we have like a billion cars a day doing two rush hours a day. We have all the boats in the ocean, all the planes in the sea, all construction machinery, all farming machinery, and all recreation machinery, and everything in between, putting out so much carbon dioxide. There's such a stress on the forests of the world, and so it's the trees that take the carbon dioxide and turn it to oxygen. So we need every tree at this time. We need every tree we can get. So I say replant America now for a cooler world, and hopefully we can slow global warming down while we go solar.
Thank you. Very sage advice. Thanks a lot. And something to ponder, too. And it doesn't have to just be in the forest. You know, one of the things that has been proven very effective, especially in congested cities, wherever a tree could be planted, wherever greenery can be planted to do so, because, of course, they absorb the carbon dioxide, give off oxygen, and they do help to cool off the heat generated by concrete and glass being reflected back down to the people on the street. So it helps. Green spaces do help. And the forests, of course, as you know, the Amazon has taken quite a beating. A lot of the forestry being destroyed by mining and other people who are mindless about the damage being caused to the environment. So thanks so much for bringing that to our attention today. From Chicago, Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, you tree?
Fine, thank you.
All right. I was kicking myself in the butt because I missed the show on Wednesday when you had Gerald Horn on there. I love listening to him talk about history and some of the things that we don't get in grade school, in high school, and even in college. So I did listen to it on the podcast, so it was very enjoyable to hear, and I would love to hear more future episodes with him on it.
Oh, he'll be around. He certainly is.
Yes.
Believe it or not, every time he gets a chance, he ducks out and writes another book, which is what
yes.
he's doing right now.
Yes, and I'm planning on getting that Counter-Revolution book pretty soon. So
it's very good. It really is a very good book.
Yeah. On Monday, you guys had a, and I didn't get a chance to call in, but you had a talk about biracialness stemming from the Viviano incident.
Well, no, I was talking about the shooting in California. The young man, Roger.
Oh yeah. I'm sorry, I got it all mixed up.
Elliot Roger.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And then it stemmed to kind of like biracialness with some of the callers. But I wanted to let you know that I'm actually a biracial person myself. My father's African American and my mother's Filipino. And the thing about it is that when I remember my mother was telling me how a lot of Americanized Filipinos won't recognize themselves as Filipinos when they integrate into American culture. So it's sort of like when you interact with Filipinos here, they're going to look at you differently because of the fact that, you know, I have African blood in me. And it's funny because when people ask me what's my racial makeup, you know, I tell them I'm black because of the fact that over here I'm recognized as a black person. The only time I'm ever recognized as Filipino is when I'm in the Philippines. And the thing is that I'm never confused about my biracial makeup. You know, I know who I am amongst, you know, a certain group of people. So it was interesting about that conversation about being accepted into, you know, white culture, and trying to be accepted into white culture. And it's funny because, like, when my mother told me about Americanized Filipinos, it was just interesting because that kind of hit home for me when you had mentioned that, because they, a lot of Filipinos here would try to, you know, integrate within American culture, especially the light-skinned Filipinos, more of the Filipinos from the northern part, because of the fact that they're much lighter than the Filipinos from Mindanao or in the south of the Philippines. So it's a very interesting, discussion that you guys had with that. So I wanted to kind of chime in on that as well.
Well, thanks. I was raising the question about the media's decision. It seemed like it was a universal decision that they would just recognize the event, which was, of course, you know, the tragic event of him taking these lives, all five of these lives, and also his own, as a case of mental illness. And the idea that I wanted people to take a pay attention to was that it wasn't as simple as mental illness. This was a case of a young man who clearly had internalized that the rights and privileges that accrued to his white British father did not automatically accrue to him as the son, because his mother, being Malaysian, his social surroundings might have been compatible with those people that he hung out with, and he did so many things to fit in. He, you know, had a mohawk, and he dyed his hair blonde, and he, you know, did all the roller skating and rollerblading and all of that kind of stuff to fit in. But the society said to him in so many ways, "You are not one of us. You're not a member of the club." And this was the lesson that was driven home to him over and over and over again, whether it was in reference to his skin color or reference to his eyes. And these are the things that he began to hate about, not just himself, but about a society that kept blocking him, because after all, human beings want to belong somewhere, and they want to belong to someone. And a basic need like that could not be fulfilled in him because of this notion of who qualifies to have such privileges. So while he had all the toys and he had all the comforts, the racist nature of society just kept locking him out. And it ended up exploding in this rage-filled killing spree that he went on. But the idea of just passing it off as mental illness avoids the question of how racism, that's racism, this is white supremacist life in the United States. This is the apartheid system we live in and live with for so long. And in some cases, it in and of itself, we have to look at it as mental illness. Why would anybody organize a system based on, you know, the shape of your eyes or the color of your skin and that kind of nonsense? See? So that was really where I was going with it, that this is the disease that America suffers from.
Yes, and it's true, because like I said, when Filipinos come over here, they change their whole complexion to try to integrate with the society, even though, you know, they're looked on as people of color, you know, just like any other non-white person.
Correct. True. Absolutely true. Thanks so much for your call. You're always very enlightening.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much. 888-874-4888. So many things going on in the news today, that this week, as a matter of fact. I'm not going to say much about it. This is your time. You define the issues the way you see them, and you bring to our attention those things that you'd like us to consider. This is your time, and I insist that you take charge of the airtime to put into the ether those things that you think warrant closer inspection. 888-874-4888. Just so you know, next week I want to do a series of special programs, and we will be examining this notion of what our role is, or how far have we come along as people who, at least we see ourselves as, quote, activists, unquote, and whether, you know, we are being truthful about that. Are we just talking the talk without walking the walk? Are we confronting systems? Are we creating changes that benefit all? And what is our role? This very central question of dealing with the legacy of supremacy in our society. This is a big thing, and it's being very, very carefully avoided. Nobody wants to deal with it. I watched an interview a couple of days ago. I forget, it might have been Tuesday or Wednesday, between Don Lemon on CNN and Morgan Freeman, the actor. And Morgan Freeman's point, he was asked by Don Lemon, I mean, is race a big deal anymore? And the response by Morgan Freeman was, it's being made to be too much of a big thing. We're making it much bigger than it ought to be, he says. And Don Lemon responds by saying, you know, yes, it is. Can't we just move along? Can't we just, you know, move beyond where we are? We seem to be stuck with this issue. And isn't it time that we move on? And by the way, he meant specifically, I guess, African-Americans, because the notion being that African-Americans, more than any other group, are just obsessed with this thing called race and racism and white supremacy. And can't we just move beyond it? And Morgan Freeman says, well, look at us. You and I are examples of ways in which we have progressed on this question of race, meaning that our accomplishment, I as an actor and you as a host at CNN, are examples of how far we have progressed. And it troubled me a bit, because it just kind of suggested that through the, and this has been a standard argument too, the progress of one or two individuals is enough to wipe out or cancel out the discussion about what happens to the whole population. And the notion that racism is really about African Americans who haven't gotten over a psychological and emotional handicap, when in fact it is work for the entire society, because everybody has been affected by it. And the work historically has been left to African Americans and Latinos and other groups who have found themselves to be, or defined themselves to be, oppressed by conditions, social or political conditions or economic conditions. And it is up to those people who are affected to do the heavy lifting on these questions. In the progressive community, the question has to be raised often, well, who's doing the work? Who's doing the work of tackling this question? And what is the response? And I'm looking, you know, the progressive community, I'm not seeing very much evidence that this is a discussion worthy of being had. Everything else takes precedence, but this is at the root of so much that is wrong in our society. And yet it is being very, very carefully avoided, deliberately avoided, so as not to, you know, as they say, to bring us back to that point which people arbitrarily have decided basically has long gone in our history. It's in the past. It no longer is relevant. So I wanted to concentrate on this discussion, and I'll do that next week, because I think the progressive community is left off the hook. I think white America has to wake up and take some responsibility for transforming the society. You know, when I was, you know, young, several centuries ago, you know, people used to say, well, such and such a person is a great journalist and they have all these credentials, and these things never impressed me. I said, you know, what would impress me is if you can show me a consistent record of confronting in your white community, confronting these issues and dealing with them. Where's the record of that kind of work? Because that is the social movement and the political movement that lifts everybody out of the morass that we are in. But part of the secret, and this is the truth of it, is that because so many people actually benefit automatically from white privilege, white skin privilege in this country, it is not an issue. And I give you the example, I'm kind of preempting myself by giving you some clues of where I'm going to go. We take the case of Hillary Clinton, for example, where we are encouraged to see her as a new vanguard of woman leadership, when in fact it is so clear, and I'm using that as an example because there are so many people who have benefited and continue to benefit from this inequity, this racial inequity, and they are lifted up, and they are really not prepared to give up the privileges. So we have to look at these things in our society. What does it mean to live in modern day America, pretending that we have solved, quote, the problem, unquote, that we are beyond it, and that people on both sides of the equation, you know, we would have the Don Lemon / Morgan Freeman argument, let's get beyond it. It is being made too big a thing than it needs to be. It is long since time we should drop this discussion and move on and get on with the work of creating an equitable society. That is daunting enough. We do not need to saddle ourselves and continue to carry this burden. And we don't need to have it as a permanent part of our conversation anymore. We have, of course, Barack Obama is proof positive that we have crossed the line here. We have moved on. We have progressed. And then we look at the evidence and we see so many indicators that tell us not only have we not progressed, we have, in fact, become re-entrenched in the discussion of where the role of white supremacy and racism in our society, the limitations that it places on everybody, the inequities it creates, the inhumanity of it, the injustice of it, and whether what will have to happen in order to just make this thing real as an honest discussion that people should engage in, and who, I mean, other than black folks who are expected to carry the burden, who in the white community is doing the work? Who is doing it? And what would it take for them to get involved and help cure the sickness in their own communities? Everybody's got to do this work. This is not just for one group alone. So let's take a little break and come back to your calls at 888-874-4888 right after a little bit more Mario Bauza. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM, I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is your time to sound off. Tell us what you're thinking at 888-874-4888. From Mexico, John, you're on the air.
Yes, Miss Eutrice, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Yes, I was thinking about the true social reality of race in America, and the 1% versus the 99%, and direct relationship to the social reality and the socioeconomic status of everyday people, especially people of color, trying to pay their basic room and board, food, acquire medicine, you know, the pursuit of happiness. And, you know, I'm in my 59-60-year-old age range. And when people talk about reparations to black people and poor people, people dismiss that. Even they have black people dismissing that from the city, state, federal, international community, and even people who have these multi-billion-dollar companies. They don't want to pay no reparations to black people on any level, whether it's 9/11 World Trade Center or veterans trying to get their benefits or the number of people who are being put out in the street from HUD and from Section 8, from school lunches, from the closing of schools. All this is being done basically to poor black people of color and poor whites. And no one wants to address giving $9 billion to NATO or anyone. How about giving something for poor people and poor kids in the ghetto and the inner cities and the rural areas who can't pay for their school lunch? No one wants to do that. And you know, I just wanted to ask you, is it possible that I can read a short poem by Marcus Garvey, who addressed to this back in the 1918s? It's only a short one. Can you allow me to do that?
Sure, go ahead.
Yes. Man to man. Yes, man to man is so unjust until we know not whom to trust. For we made of life a lie and treating man less than a fly. To tell the reason why it is so, into history we must go, revealing crime after crime, from Cain and Abel to this time. Our God made man in his perfect form, and to the standard to conform. But in his ways of self alone, he crushed the good and built the throne. A regal personage is he, as proud and selfish as can be. Forgetting God, He robs and kills and lays the course of human ills. Is there no help that we can give to brighten life and truths to live? Yes, there is much for you to do in treating man as Christ did you. If we should change the old bad way, the God would shine in us each day. Then life would be a happy dream, a radiant, fair morning beam. And that was written, stand corrected, in 10/25/1927 by Marcus Mosiah Garvey, our political philosopher and prophet.
It also formed the basis of Bob Marley's song, Man to Man is So Unjust. You don't know who to trust. Your worst enemy can be your best friend, and your best friend your worst enemy. So the poem, what is the poem supposed to mean? As you've read it, what is it supposed to convey? What are you conveying through this poem?
Well, I'm conveying that I'm a Pan-Africanist, I'm a Garveyite, and that black people on an international level and the diaspora, we have to instill in our children, our grandchildren, and people unborn that reparations is something that is not going to be compromised on no level, on and no form. Taxation without proper representation is the order of the day, and we have to hold the torch for humanity. We are humanity. We are the ones who are the forerunners of the human race.
But you know, here's the thing, and I'm not disagreeing with you. I have a certain frustration, a level of frustration with what I call a theoretical alliance with something, as opposed to the work of it. The question I want us to start focusing on, to be very honest, I've said it time and again, the work has been done. More than enough work has been done to establish the objective conditions that exist. We don't need another poll. We don't need another survey. We don't need another study. We don't need anything else except the will to make things happen. And, you know, when we deal with that, I've been dealing with community issues for a long time. And guess what? It's the same people doing the work. It's the same 5 people, the same 7 people, the same 13 people. They're the ones doing the work. And that's true throughout all communities. A lot of people talk, but it's the same small band of people doing the heavy lifting. And the question is, when will folks get to the point of saying, I have to do something, I have to engage, I have to be motivated to put my 2 cents in the pot? You know, today, for example, there's a news item. The Koch brothers have donated or will be donating $25 million to the United Negro College Fund. On the one hand, you say that is great. On the other hand, you go, my God. You know, you can't help but say it. But what it suggests is that when folks relieve themselves of the burden of funding their own liberation, funding their own interests, investing in themselves and doing the work, you end up being open to this kind of thing that looks like philanthropy.
It's a mirage because...
But you know,
when you
what
speak
I'm trying
on
to
your
say
show,
is,
the first
I'm
thing
trying,
you always
let me
tell
just, let me
listeners
just say this.
Is to be
No, let me just say this. It is imperative that people get off of this dime. You know, people tell me all day long about what Marcus Garvey said or what Malcolm X said or what Frederick Douglass said and what Ida B. Wells said. Guess what? They did their work, and they did it sacrificially. But when it comes to us today, and I'm talking across the board, for all the professions that we make about wanting a better world and wanting to see things improve, and we look and we say, well, gee, if everybody actually does feel this way, how come our schools are shutting down? How come we permit this crappy level of hospital care in our neighborhoods? How come we permit the world's largest population of incarcerated people? It is just not jiving. The talk is just not jiving with the reality. And it's time to make the two somehow meet. You know, we got to get off of this theoretical business of feeling comfort by telling me what people said. They did their work. And we would honor them by taking what they said to heart, by implementing the plans that they presented at great cost, in some cases, at cost of their very lives, and by moving in a direction that they would have us move across the board to create a better society. From Rosedale, Jose, you're on the air.
Hello,
you're on the air, Rose. Jose.
Greetings. You know, I listened to everything, your response a moment ago, and it is so much on target. I've oftentimes tell our people that there's no need to reinvent the wheel. Because if we should stop and study everything that those ancestors have left us, the blueprint, right? They are everything is there, from Marcus Garvey, as the brother just quoted, to Malcolm X, to Dr. King, to Fannie Lou Hamer, you name it. There's nothing that we are experiencing today that they have not articulated in their assessment of the condition that we are in as a people. But as you said, everybody, all of our people, none of are not on the same wavelength. And most of the leadership that I find in our community nowadays are political and cultural hustlers and charlatans. And then everybody is there trying to feather their own nest and do the will of their masters. And we are not their masters. They go into political office. They say they are there to represent us as a people, their people. But when they go in the halls of power where the spoils are being distributed and discussed, our knees are absent from all of that. And so I don't know what it will take to for our people to have what the Christian people call an epiphany, because that is what we need, an awakening as a people. Some of us have that fire in us, and we are doing whatever little we can do, but it is not enough. We are not reaching the masses of the people because they have become complacent. They have been occupied with all kind of frivolous things out there. And I don't know. Maybe it's condition. Maybe it's when we reach the door to the crematorium. That's when most of our people will wake up. But I want to ask you real quick on two issues. The issue with this Sterling situation here and the supposed sale of this basketball team, which I believe was a scam from the beginning. But I thought that if at least the team was sold or turned over to two black folks, at least I believe, I felt that some good would have come out of it. Given the fact that I don't know if even one whole team is owned by Africans in this country, right? So I would like your opinion on that. And lastly, I was in Jamaica. We talk about reparations a lot, and I am of the opinion that there is no way Africans in this world or any other world is going to get any semblance of reparation until they have the power to demand it. And the way things are now, the entire continent of Africa is not in any position to even support their people outside of Africa. But I was in Jamaica a few years ago, and Randall Robinson was down there. He attended a conference on reparation. And after it was over, I asked him, all these learned professors and scholars were there, and I asked Mr. Robinson, I said, tell me something, my brother. You know, here in this country, here, this little country, Jamaica, we have families that are still living here in this country that they can trace their ancestry all the way back through slavery, beyond slavery, and so forth. And they are here benefiting from their ill-gotten gains. I said, don't you think it would make sense for the folks who are fighting here for reparation to go after those folks since they are here, they are alive, their assets are here, and so forth? And let this be a test case. And at least let us go after something where we make it possible to have a victory, because we have had too many failures as a people, and we need something, some semblance of a victory. Let's go after the people here and then use it as a trial run for the larger issue. And he said, well, you know, I'm just a guest here, and, you know, I really can't, you know, talk on that, but because I'm really, I was invited here to speak on this matter. So, Sister Utri, maybe you can give me your opinion on both topics, because I'm, as an old man, getting ready to go through the pearly gates, I want to be able to tell, I would like to be able to tell Marcus and Malcolm and Fannie Lou Hamer and Harriet Tubman and all those people that when I left down here, the black folks down here, the Africans down here, they had an epiphany and they'll start the work to move towards their real liberation.
Maybe so you're an old man. You're a very old man, huh?
Yes, my queen, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Well, you know, I tell you, the story with the Donald Sterling, and that's a very, very, very detailed story. And mm-hmm. It would take some time to unravel it.
Okay.
But let me put it this way. I did say from the very beginning mm-hmm. that the players should never have been involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
Because when it was time for them to stand up
yes.
and be accounted for, which is when Elgin Baylor had a just a cause of action against Donald Sterling, they ran for the hills.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I don't think any of these players, present or past,
mm-hmm.
established a legal defense fund for Elgin to say, well, look, you know, we can't be public because of, you know, whatever mm-hmm. considerations, but we each put $10,000 in a pot because we know you have to win your case.
Yes.
They never did that. When there was a reason to be involved, when there was a reason to be vocal, when there was a reason to take on the NBA, they had nothing to say.
Mm-hmm.
And the cause of, you know, some this guy with his mistress and whatnot, this is when you choose to come in. And as I said, the fact that they came in,
mm-hmm.
The way they came into this discussion literally sent the value of the team zooming out of all proportion. This man who bought a team for $12 million
mm-hmm.
is able to sell it for $2 billion. That's a 16,000% profit.
What a racket.
And they're not going to get a penny of it. So what happened was, and it will take some time for them to realize that the strategy that they should have adopted was just to say, we are looking forward to a very exciting season, and that's all we have to say. Because it's the institution that they would have, that they should have jammed up.
Mm-hmm.
But they came out and basically surrounded the institution, and look, the institution is doing just fine.
Yes.
Mr. Sterling is walking away with $2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't care whether they call him, all of his strategies worked. They, you know, he got himself declared demented or mentally incapacitated. He did all his, you know, acting and made it look like, well, he was losing his mind. This is not a person who's losing his mind. It's fantastic. He did a fantastic thing. And the black players facilitated one of the greatest profit windfalls of all time in the history of the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
And they won't see a penny of that, really.
Mm-hmm.
What they could have done and should have done was when the case came forward from Elgin Baylor, who was capped, Donald Sterling capped his salary
mm-hmm.
at about $300,000 a year, a little bit more than that. Mm-hmm. And the next person he hired after that got $12 million
wow.
contract. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at the fact that with all of the knowledge you think these folks should have,
mm-hmm.
and they should have the ability by now to make sense of the world that they're operating in, and they operate at such an elemental level with as if they have no sense of the complexity of the sport that they're in and how they're making a living and their role in generating revenue in that sector. They have no understanding of it. So they place themselves as workhorses. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're happy to make the millions that they're getting, and I'm glad that they are.
Mm-hmm.
But they seem to have no understanding, no political understanding, no appreciation for what their role is
mm-hmm.
in the billions and billions of dollars being generated in that sector. That depends almost exclusively on African American talent.
Their labor, yes.
Yeah, that's how they see themselves.
Yeah.
So you can't help people. This is exactly the point. It comes right out of the previous point we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They have not moved beyond that point of seeing themselves as the labor.
Mm-hmm.
They have not seen themselves as an integral part of the vibrancy of the sector, the profitability of the sector, and this is extraordinary profit. When somebody could afford to pay $2 billion, it means that they know they'll make at least $5 or $6 billion.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know?
Yes, yes.
But when people have no interest in moving beyond a certain level where in their minds, it's just about, well, I could get my $5 million or $10 million or $20 million or whatever it is, and I'm happy with that,
mm-hmm.
and it's about me and nothing else. This is what you get.
Yeah.
You have an entire industry predicated on African-American power,
mm-hmm.
but it's athletic power, not economic or business power, mm-hmm. and that's the way they want it. These people belong in an education camp. They need to, every summer, they need to take courses
in,
you know, what the reality is and their role in facilitating their own exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't help people like that.
Yeah.
And so the guy who is said to be so demented and so sick and so racist and everything, he even got a church to come and put its arms around, you know, to love him back into humanity.
Tell you about those Christians.
Well, they did it for Bill Clinton. All those ministers flew down to Washington to just love him back into. So they had Brother Sterling down there, and they surrounded him, and they just loved him right back.
They probably baptized him, too.
And that's where we are. That's and we haven't changed that role, and nobody seems to be able to get to these folks and say, listen, you know, Just think about what it is you're doing. Spend an extra 5 minutes and think about what you're doing. From the very beginning, I said these ball players should have been ashamed of themselves, mm-hmm. that this is the time they choose to step forward. They step forward to protect the institution. And it's the institution still has not been held responsible for this systemic problem that Donald Sterling uncovered. You see, that's the value of this whole explosion. He lifted the scab off of the institution, and we saw what even he, as a billionaire, the rules that applied and why he was so scared that, look, you can do anything, but you are jeopardizing my ability to make money. And in this club, mm-hmm. I am a minority as a Jewish man. Mm-hmm. And I am not going to have you jeopardize my ability to continue to make profits and make a living. And therefore, the question should have been, to what degree was Donald Sterling's conduct and ways of thinking and doing things symptomatic of the institution? But you had all these ball players running to throw themselves around the institution when their tactic should have been exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this is not us. We're not involved. We play basketball. That's our job. If you didn't have the courage to step forward in behalf and in the support of Elgin Baylor, you cancel out any right, really, to step in now and act as if you are somehow ameliorating the situation, and you're not. And that's what we saw. Their lack of understanding, their lack of strategy, their lack of appreciation for even their own contribution to the sector. Thanks so much for your call. Thank you all for your calls today. And let's meet again on Monday, same bat time, same bat channel, right here on PRN.FM. Coming up next, Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. Send me a note on leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with UTV Sleeve. Bye-bye. Have a great weekend.